Good morning, everyone. Coming to you live from somewhere in the Middle East, it is Saturday morning's hottest streaming media political talk show, Inside the Eye, live with The Fed. Heck, did I just hear someone tell a standing member of Congress that if it were up to them, they would dump the Israelis tomorrow? Sounds like something you might hear right here on Inside the Eye Live.
The Fetch. What a man. Oh, my God. You have to listen to that show. He was brilliant. I didn't know he had gonads of steel like that and a mind like a frigging razor. I didn't realize he was so clear. He cut through this that cognitive dissonance that is going on in the whole Patriot music movement.
And now it's time for Inside the Eye Live. Intelligent media for the politically aware. All right, everybody, good morning from Amman, Jordan, and streaming globally across the World Wide Web. This is The Fetch, and you are live Inside the Eye. Today's date is Saturday, August the 12th, 2017. A good Saturday morning to all of you listening in European and Asian time zones, and a good late afternoon to evening to everyone listening. Did I say that correctly? No, I didn't say that correctly at all, because that was written wrong. Anyways, good afternoon. Good morning to everybody listening in America. How's that? And Canada. And time zones south of that. And a good late afternoon and evening to everybody listening in European and Asian time zones. And no wonder you wrote that twice, dude. That doesn't look good. Good morning, wherever you are listening out there on the World Wide Web, or our FM and micro FM broadcasting outlets, may all be well with you and yours. You know, you think I say that every week pretty much. You think I'd have it down. I wouldn't need to even read it. But generally, I don't know. I just like to read that darn thing when I start my show, and I wrote it wrong. Anyways, the weather here in Amman has been on the warm side, but certainly not overly hot, with temperatures topping off between 91 to 93 degrees. Depending on where you are located in Amman, we are sitting right now at 90 degrees with virtually no wind to speak of, at least at my location. The reports locally are claiming about 12 miles per hour out of the west, but I don't see that, as the trees in front of my house and way up on the top of the hill, they don't seem to be moving much at all, you know, if any at all, really. So it seems very calm where I'm at. However, you know, it's been a nice day, though. You know, it's been pleasant, at least 90, 91 is not so bad. And then we're going to be getting down to like 78 degrees at 10 o'clock. And then we're going to actually experience something that, again, we covered a few weeks ago, talking about hot temperatures sometimes here in the Middle East. And that was something called as a heat burst. And that's where there's some air compression going on, and the temperatures will actually rise at night. And we're actually expecting a moderate heat burst tonight. Between the 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock hours, we're expecting an increase in temperatures of 1 to 2 degrees, and that will probably last no more out to, let's say, 11 o'clock to midnight. It's maybe a two-hour situation here, and then the temperatures will start to fall again, and then we're expected to get down to 75 degrees in the hour before sunrise. So throughout the night, it's going to be, as you can imagine, very, very pleasant here. The winds are going to be dying down 4 or 5 miles per hour, so not a whole lot of wind is going to be happening here. You know, funny, someone sent me an email or a comment, don't recall exactly which one it was, regarding the air pressure, humidity, and wind direction. Saying, hey, can you give that out also? You know, I pretty much always do give out the wind direction and occasionally the humidity. And the site I use to gather the weather report doesn't post the air pressure, at least on a page that I'm looking at. And so would have to go find it. And I actually had to go find it to help you out here. So the air pressure, just in case you want to know, they're out there. To those of you who are asking, it's 1010 millibars. And the reference is 922 millibar at an altitude of 816 meters. So as you said, now you can go ahead and set your altimeter. Perhaps I hopefully gave you enough information. And the humidity is sitting at around 20%. And the dew point, I don't know where the dew point is. Okay, so that covers pretty much all of the weather here in Amman, it's warm. I've shut the house to keep the street noise out. Yeah, my house is now feeling like an oven. And that's just the way it goes. But hey, what can I say? Better that than having a bunch of honking horns. And you don't hear it, actually, quite frankly, through the microphone too much, but I hear it. And that kind of breaks my concentration quite a bit. Join me in the chat room, InsideTheEyeLive.com. That's InsideTheEyeLive.com. Click on the live chat button. That gets you in the door. We're already humming along a little bit compared to this past Thursday. If you didn't catch the news, I was on Inside the Eye Live primetime. It was a new show. We've done it 2 weeks in a row. I'm not sure the studio is going to order up a third show. They haven't gotten in touch with me, and I, quite frankly, haven't gotten in touch with them. But we've been running for two straight weeks an Inside the Eye Live primetime show, and that's been going out at 6 to 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern. It's really the number one time slot here on Revolution Radio. And we had a very good showing last week. I thought we did a much better job last week than the week before. But the archives are way down. But nonetheless, we did a much better job. Maybe that's because more of you showed up and listened to it live. That might be. Also, some news. We've set up a new... So everybody listening, please take a note of this, because we have set up a new listener call-in number. So to Frank and Chewbacca and everybody else out there, guys, we've set up again a new listener telephone number for Inside the Eye Live. The new number is 1-USA, of course, 323. That's Los Angeles. I found my old ladder where I used to live, where my apartment was. So 1-323-275-1314. So once again, the new listener call-in for Inside the Eye Live is 1-323-275-1314. So make a note of that. Reprogram your telephones. And if you've got my Skype address, of course, that is still valid. You can reach me through the Skype address. If you'd like to call me through Skype, you should send me a message. So I'm not giving that out over the air all the time, because it's also my private Skype address. So send me a message saying, Fetch, we'd like to call you, and we'll try to arrange something for you. Kind of a good show lined up today. We've got Brendan O'Connell. He's going to be coming. I don't have his website. I should have him send me the website. I'm kind of like discombobulated on that. But send me the... Brendan O'Connell is going to be in hour number two. And I think Miriam Al-Fatah from the website Libya Against Superpower Media, something like that. You'd think I'd be prepared, but I'm not. Been very busy today, quite frankly, outside. So I just kind of got home an hour ago and just sat behind the computer. So nonetheless, we've got two guests lined up for you today. We're looking forward to a good chat. And gee, phone calls already coming in. I hope that's testing the new number. Hi, 813. Let's see if that will add. There you are. Hi, welcome to Inside the Eye Live.
I was just calling to listen.
You're just calling to listen. You know what? This is not the listener call-in number.
I'll look that up.
You know what? Yeah, I don't have it on my website. Maybe I do on the listen page. Inside the Eye Live /listen, there's a listen number. This is not the listen number. This is listener participation number.
Okay, I can find that. Great show, though.
So whatever the studio is using for the listen number, that's still valid.
Okay, thank you.
And just out of curiosity, can you tell me what number you called?
The one you just gave out. I thought
fantastic.
That was
fantastic. It's working. You can go on record as being the first one to actually use it. Okay, so awesome that it works. That's actually good. But I got to turn my cell phones off. Thanks for calling and testing it, I guess. But check back for the studio. It's the normal numbers for the studio for the listening.
Will do. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. All right, everybody, the telephone number is working. I just got to turn off all my cell phones, because what happens is everything is directing to cell phones, and then it doesn't go to my desktop till the last, and that's sometimes kind of frustrating, so hang tight here. You know, I've got two cell phones, and you know how it is. I've got a Saudi phone, and I've got a Jordanian phone, and I don't mix the two SIM cards together because of the size of the SIMs and all that kind of crappy stuff. So let me turn this LAN off. Come on, turn off. There you go. You're turned off. Okay, so everything now is turned off. Things should go directly to the phone. All right, join us in the chat room again, InsideTheEyeLive.com already. You know, I have the – we did the Inside the Eye Live primetime this past Thursday. And, again, I thought we had a pretty good showing this week. Quite frankly, I should get in touch with the studio, see if they want to order up a third one. For me, it's easy. You know, don't do it because I just get the Thursday off. Thursday's here, everybody. It's like Friday for you. Out there in the world, unless you're here in the Middle East. Thursday is like Friday night. So then Friday is like Sunday, and Saturday is kind of like Saturday. So basically, everyone's out and about having a heck of a good time on Friday, in America perhaps, TGIF, but here's TGIT. And so nonetheless, I was there, and but I kind of lose my Friday night, my Thursday nights here. So, but it was funny, you know, we say go to the chat room, and I had like seven of you guys there. Some of you can vouch for that. I think we got as high as 12 people. And obviously, it feels funny. People even said, you know what, Fetch, you broadcasting in primetime actually feels funny. But what can I do? You know, I had a great time. I'm just doing 2 hours. Then we did 2 hours after that. On Radio Werewolf, or Werewolf Radio, I should say. I did an hour after that show. So I did 3 hours and like 20 minutes, starting at 1 o'clock in the morning this past Thursday, and had a great time, quite frankly. And then we're going to be doing another show Monday night, the Brian Rue Show. And Brian Rue does a video podcast type of show. We are set here. We've been doing a lot in the video realm. More to cover that at the bottom of the hour, but we got a lot of software set up. We are going to be doing our very first production video show with Brian Rue on the Brian Rue Show this Monday. And I don't know how long it takes for him to archive that, but I'm sure it's not going to be all that long. I don't believe we're going to be streaming live. Now, maybe we are. I should ask him if we are. But nonetheless, we'll get all the details here on Inside the Eye Live. Interesting stuff. You know, I was going through the news. Again, I just got home an hour ago. We were out and about having to take care of some issues here. I got to take care of visas and stuff like that, getting things done. You know, my visas and everything are going to expire this coming week. So I have to take care of things, right? But I was looking at a newspaper, and it's like they were – somebody tried to smuggle in like a few hundred people into Yemen. And unfortunately for the people who are trying to get smuggled into Yemen, and again, this is coming from Eritrea, Somalia, this part of the Horn of Africa over there, they were ruthlessly thrown into the water. The smugglers threw these people into the water. And a lot of drowning. I heard over 100 people drowned. So this invasion coming from Africa is all over the region. Africa has tried to invade Saudi Arabia. I've already told you many stories of the hundreds of thousands of people who were kicked out as Saudi started to tighten their border controls. They're trying to smuggle into Yemen. Africa has a problem. I mean, Africa as a political infrastructure, when you look at the politics of Africa, they have a problem. No doubt about it. You know, talk about kicking out Whitey. Well, you've kicked out Whitey, but you're just taking on another colonial power, and that's China. And China and their language are not going to be as easy for you to adapt to, and the culture and the religion and everything. And quite frankly, the Chinese are not as nice as us, as the West. So you guys in Africa, you know, you can raise your fists and do all you want, but the fact of the matter is you guys don't have your heads on straight. You know, you guys haven't figured it out how to actually create a civilization that functions. And you may say, Fetch, no, I'm not being harsh, guys. You know, I saw a video recently with some Chinese guy, and he was talking to probably Kenya or Mozambique or something like this. And the Chinese guy is chiding the African guy, and the African guy spoke and understood Chinese. So he was talking and says, you know, you guys in Africa, you're never going to develop. You're just not good custodians. And they said, you know what? Look at your train system, they said. This train system, we didn't even have inside of China in the 1930s. And this is something that the white man left you, and you never have built it from the time that they left it to you, and we didn't even have it back in the 1930s. He said, now look at us. We have our high-speed rails. He said, the problem with the Africans right now is they just don't protect, nurture, and protect, but they just don't nurture and preserve what's been given to them. And this is, of course, a problem as we head forward with all this massive immigration. They're not going to protect anything for you. They're not going to protect anything for your heritage. They're not going to protect anything for your culture, society. And they're just not prone to it. You know, we talked about this week, we had a massive issues starting to flare up now with the with this migrant crisis, this invasion crisis. Italy is reported to now have shut their borders, and not the borders, but the ports to some of these NGO ships. At least one NGO ship I heard was turned back. They tried to go to Lampedusa Island, which is actually pretty close to Africa now. I'm learning more about this as I start to study it, and it was rejected there. It's been wandering around. Another NGO ship off the Libyan coast has been shot at, warning shots anyways, to move away from the coast, because even the Libyans are getting sick of this problem. Because you got all these people coming up in through Libya, and now all the Libyans are starting. Not only does Libya have to deal with the war and the civil war and the just a terrible environment now that Gaddafi's been thrown out, hey, they're tired of it also. So everybody's getting tired of this issue. Spain has shut their border in what's called the Ceuta. Ceuta, I didn't even know about this. See, I'm learning as we go along. There's a small 75-mile strip of land right at the very tip of the Straits of Gibraltar. So basically, we as Europeans control vis-a-vis Spain, the southern tip of the Straits of Gibraltar, vis-a-vis their territory called Ceuta, which is then the northern part of Africa. And then, of course, they control the northern tip of the Straits of Gibraltar from Spain. So Spain controls both sides of the Straits of Gibraltar, which is probably a good thing. Well, this week we had something like 180 migrants from Africa literally overrun the border station. Literally, they just overran it. And then the Europeans are so stupid. Really, the Europeans have become so stupid. You know what they do? They capture them. They round them up. And they put them into processing centers. And then the processing centers wait until some NGO is able to clear these people to go on and go into Europe. How stupid is that? I saw some tweet or something to me the other day. It says something to the effect, Fetch, it's kind of like this. You break into somebody's house and then you wait there until everybody says it's okay for you to stay, but you can't kick them out. And that's basically what's going on in Europe now. The Europeans, I tell you what, the Western Europeans from France, Italy, Germany, parts of UK, London, Ireland. What are you guys doing, man? Spain, what are you doing? What are you doing? Do you have a freaking clue how to handle your own borders? You know, you guys have fought so many wars, lost so many people fighting off basically each other because a bunch of Jews in the middle want you to fight each other. And now you're going to just lay over and die and let sub-Saharan Africans invade you and take you over because, well, hey, you know, you're just nice guys. Well, you're not nice guys. You're just stupid. You're becoming stupid. You know, we hear about years ago, and I'm talking about thousands of years, okay? Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Hey, what did you do to get rid of all of this, you know, this riffraff, this back then it was the Islamic or the Muslim hordes from Europe. And the guy says, one of the leaders said, I slaughtered every darn one of them. And of course, we don't have that today. At all. But, you know, you have to wonder if that's where Jews want this to head, because they're basically telling Europeans, you're either going to have to fight for your survival or you're going to die, because we're going to create conditions on the ground that does not allow you to basically live anymore without first fighting for your right and space to live. So it's going to get interesting over the next 10 years, 20 years, as to what really happens. Saw some interesting news coming out of America also. Birth rates, white birth rates, recently have actually ticked up to be ahead of everybody else for the first time in a really, really long time. And that's honestly a great thing to hear. And then you've got this issue going on with Unite the Right and the Charlottes and Charlottevilles and people showing up en masse to basically, let's look at it this way. America is, whether you guys like it or not, listening to this show, and most of you I know like it, but whether you like it or not, guys, it's a European country. We are based on Western civilization. We're not based on some mestizo, I don't want to call it a monstrosity, I like their food, but we're not based on something from China. We're not based on something from Japan. We're not based on something from the Middle East. And the way it has been set up, with the way the media has attacked the people, you know, the way that the troll world attacked the messengers a decade ago. Well, a lot of this has changed. A lot of this is now moved to the fact that I'm not even a minority in speaking about this anymore. I can actually go prime time and get away with it. Heck, you couldn't get away with it 5-7 years ago. But now we're kind of but now you got like literally, Nazis. You know, they like to call them Nazis. I think the UVA campus, I think that's the University of Virginia. You've got torchlit rallies at night. And, you know, the torches are kind of like a European thing, you know. When Europeans get together at night, you know, they like to burn our torches. I used to love to actually have a torch around the house. And part of that is because whether you agree with it or not, I'm going to say it. We in the West are the beacons of light to many of the world out there. It's not Jews. There's nothing about Jewish culture or society that is a beacon of light out there. You know, fascinating piece came out again on YouTube. This is how stupid Jews are, quite frankly, as a people, as a culture, as a franchise, as a brand, okay? If you just want to call it a brand, you know, brand Jew. Brand Jew, that sounds kind of funny. I don't know, I'm in a good mood today and I got nothing to talk about. But brand Jew, you know what they did? Jews are very clever. They sponsor something known as these diversity training inclusionary religious get-togethers. I don't know what they have. They got it's brand Jew, so they got like fancy names for all this. And they're out there in their homeland called Israel, right? And so what they did is they brought over Muslims from America and Christians from America, and of course you have Jews from America, and then of course you got other cultures coming in, maybe from the UK and France and elsewhere. And it was a big gathering, and they brought all of these kids, basically 19, 20, 21, 22, 25, something like that, to a particular square. And Israeli soldiers started to segregate the Christians from the Muslims. And the Jews, of course, were with the Christians. So the Jews and the Christians were together, and the Israeli military started to then take all of the Muslims and separate them, because they had gone into one of these areas where it is forbidden for anybody to intermingle. Yeah, so that's the funny part about the hypocrisy and the idiocy of following Jews all the time. Here they want to talk about inclusion and inclusivity and tolerance and you can't be racist and all this other crap that they want to throw on your face when we have valid complaints about what's going on out there. Okay? We have valid complaints. And you watch them in their own country. It's like, you, over here. And it was so great because you heard one Israeli soldier go to the other Israeli soldier in English, say, hey, these are Americans. And the other soldier says, I don't care. All the Muslims over here, over here, over here. And then the Americans, and they were Americans. You can tell by the voice. Look, again, I'm not somebody that's like so narrow. I'm not going to allow any culture to live among me. That's silly, in my opinion. But I want to keep it Western civilization at the same time. And so the Muslim guy, And he's very articulate, very pleasant sounding, very, hey, what's up? He said, I'm part of this group here. Why am I being moved over here? And he's very talking in a very polite manner. And the Jew is just getting like, he wasn't so angry. He said, but you're not Christian. You're not Jew. This is not an area where we allow people to intermingle. You're not allowed to be here. You have to go over there. And they said, but we have to go up these stairs. They had to get like up this flight of stairs. And this is actually on YouTube. And this is really Israel. This is Israel. So they're going up the stairs. Got a ping here. What's the ping? Okay, that was... we've got Brendan O'Connell. He's standing by pretty much. Everybody's checked in. Miriam Al-Fatah, I just saw her log in too. So it's going to be kind of a fun show today. Let's see. Let me take this one. I need to get rid of this. Decline that. Okay. Don't know how to do that. All right. I'll try to get rid of this. You know, we just security issues on the internet. Let's see. Where were we? So anyways, in Israel, are we coming up on the break here? We should be coming up on the break pretty soon, but I'll try to get the story in. They had to go up a flight of stairs, guys, basically. And the flight of stairs was off limits to the Muslims. Off limits, not just to the Muslims, but off limits to Americans. Off limits to Americans. See, Israel wants to steal, and Jews in America want to basically extort tens of billions of dollars from the United States and its people. Yet when our people go there, if they're not like treading on eggshells and visiting certain areas, they have a high risk of being killed, imprisoned, or certainly discriminated against. That is the Jewish brain. It's inside life. Tell it. All right, everybody. Welcome back. It's the Fetch Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware. Right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. The largest listener sponsored and supported, at least one of the largest. I don't even know. I just say that, right? Anyways, it's one of the larger listener sponsored and supported radio networks out there. And again, we've been doing this for a long time. We get a lot of support from the station for sure. So we're looking forward to obviously keeping everything rolling. And the way we do that, everybody, is just get out there and again, help support the network by putting out a donation out there and, you know, supporting it that way. You know, we like to see basically a monthly type of donation, something like that, so that you just kind of make your thing and defend it. Not defend it. I'm looking at some stuff on the net here. Basically just support the network again. And what can I say? What can I say? Just it takes money to get everything rolling. So, make your way over to freedomslips.com. There's many ways to support the station there. Of course, how you do that, when you do that, whenever you can afford to do that, it's up to you, obviously. But your support is indeed appreciated all throughout the value chain here. I don't know what's the matter with me today. My brain actually feels pretty good. All right, it's the ITEL Cat Report. Let's get to the ITEL Cat Report. It's proudly sponsored by North Kakalaki Trading Post. Good services and solutions for all creatures, great and small. It's inconveniently located at the corner of Walk and Don't Walk and by Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club, a radio show hosted by Blackbird Nine, a.k.a. Frederick C. Blackburn. He's an NSA whistleblower, 9/11 truth advocate, former 32-degree Mason, and a former North Carolina House candidate. And you can hear Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club every Wednesday evening from 8 to 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern on Spreaker. That's right. So for more information, visit blackbird9tradingpost.org. Just a couple fun stories with the cats for today's show. And one is One Eye. That's my big male. He is something. I'll tell you what. He wants to go out usually like 6, sometimes 4:30, which is not good. But 4:30, 5:30, 6:30, something like that. He wants to go to the bathroom. So we don't have a litter box in the house. So he comes in, he screams, he wakes you up, and you got to get up, and you got to go open the door. Well, we've had a gal staying here, and that's kind of like we said, you guys, you know, she was up because she has to get up anyways to go to work like by 7 in the morning. So One Eye's like screaming, 6:30 in the morning, and so she lets him out. And then when I came back in, I didn't hear any of this. I heard him screaming, but I didn't hear the rest of it. I was sleeping. So the guy comes back down, and then the girls here say to the other girl, and said, you have to just give him some dry food. Let him eat something, because otherwise he's going to get angry with you. And she ignored it. She thought it was funny. Well, he gets angry. One day he was angry, so he basically went up. We put all of the trash cans up, because we don't want Bruiser to like be digging in the trash at night. So he just walked over to the trash cans, just smacked them. Now they're empty. There's nothing in there, but he smacked them and threw them on the floor. Well, yesterday he wanted to eat. It's like, dude, you do dead, really. You let me out. I did my thing. Now I got to come back and eat. And she refused to feed him. So what did he do? There was some ground beef on the table, the countertop. And he knows he can't eat it. See, that ground beef has been there the whole night. He knows not to eat it. It was just thawing out for food to eat out of the freezer. So he just picked it up, and he looked at the girl. And then she said, you can hear her, like, why don't I put that down, put that down. So he threw it on the floor. And then everyone's laughing at this girl, saying, see, we told you. If One Eye comes up, he's got to eat. You got to feed him. So that's exactly what happened. You know, he got angry. And then I noticed something very fascinating about my blind cat. Now, he's blind, literally blind. And I've got basically, I don't know how big the living room is, but it's basically a square floor plan. You know, it's basically square. And I've been noticing, every time I look at this cat, he's like dead center inside of the squares. And it's basically 20 centimeter squares. So whatever that is, four meters, I guess. And so I'm looking at Bruiser, and I'm saying, Bruiser, man, I didn't say anything, but I'm looking, I'm like, I'll be darned. You know what this cat is doing, guys? It's pretty fascinating, because he can't see. He is able to navigate virtually to dead center of the room. So when it is empty and, you know, there's no furniture all over and there's no guests, he locates to the dead center of the room, and he's actually able to find the dead center. I started to count I'm like, this isn't, come on. Every time I'm looking at my cat, he's like there. And so I start to count the squares. Gee, he's 9.5 in this way, which means he's 10.5 that way. And then he's 9.5 this way. Dang, this cat is actually so clever that inside the main room where we live, which is, of course, your living room, to make himself at home with everybody, being blind, he locates at the dead center of the room. And from there, he hears the surrounding of what's going on inside the room, of course, outside further to the house, you know, outside, and then to the balcony, the kitchen, etc. So very fascinating. I thought that was kind of cool, you know, seeing that I've got a cat that's actually pretty darn smart. And, well, that is the ITEL Cat Report. See, sometimes it's kind of interesting. It's proudly sponsored by North Kakalaki Trading Post. Good services and solutions for all creatures, great and small, and it's inconveniently located at the corner of Walk and Don't Walk, and by Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club. It's a radio show hosted by Blackbird Nine, a.k.a. Frederick C. Blackburn. He's an NSA whistleblower, 9/11 truth advocate, former 32-degree Mason, and a former North Carolina House candidate. And you can hear Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club every Wednesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. For more information, everybody, visit BlackbirdNineTradingPost.org. That's BlackbirdNineTradingPost.org. And give it a listen. I know a lot of people do, and they appreciate the show, so you should too. And now it's time for the Oy Vey moment. Better plug that in first, dude. See, my brain's actually kind of working today. All right, go.
Oy vey. Oy gewalt. It's like another shower.
Oy vey.
Oy vey.
Oy vey, everybody.
Hollywood is run by Jews. It's owned by Jews. Very goddamn angry at some of the Jews.
I thrive on William Pierce.
Oy vey!
Oy vey, everybody!
Oy vey!
The Oy Vey Moment is brought to you by Werewolf Radio and HeartlandOnline.net. Radio Werewolf is now streaming 24 hours of no-nonsense, uncensored radio centered around the pro-European Western civilization spirit. And be sure to catch all their live shows at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern. To listen live or catch the archived shows and curated content, visit werewolfradio.com. That's WERWolfRadio.com. And if you want to expand your information options and find like-minded content, visit heartlandonline.net, where you will find many popular and insightful Western-centric podcasts, news articles, videos, music, and much more, including yours truly, The Fetch, and Inside the Eye Live. So just remember, Radio Werewolf, that's W-E-H-R Wolf, and heartlandonline.com. And that's right. We actually have a new commercial sponsor for the Oy Vey moment. It's very, very cool. So thank you for that to Radio Werewolf. We had Dion Werewolf on the show last week, and then I did a reciprocal this week. That was kind of planned, but his sponsorship, when he heard it was available, he actually asked me if he could sponsor it, and I said, absolutely. We're serious about that. So we've got the sponsorship up and ship. I got to be careful with my words. I'm talking too fast. But we got the sponsorship up and all the advertisements are up. So that means that the Cat Report is now fully booked, at least throughout the end of the year. Frederick C. Blackburn booked that thing out through December 31st. So, Frederick, if you're listening, you got that booked till December 31st. And now the Oy Vey moment has been booked for the next 5 weeks. So we're very happy to hear that. This week's Oy Vey moment is coming out of I think it's Charlotte. I was late, so I apologize to everybody. I didn't get everything. Yeah, Charlottesville. There's this, what they call a social justice warrior. I wish I could get her vocals up there quick enough, but I can't. But her name is Emily Gorsensky, and she had a literal meltdown. The funny thing is about these liberals out there is they've always been insane, but we've always been tolerant enough to allow them to show their insanity without showing any show of force in return. Well, today's younger generation, they finally are starting to get it. You know, they're waking up. They are starting to march. There was estimated, they're saying upwards of 6,000 people coming into Charlottesville for this event. And obviously, all the kvetching and whining is going to be coming very... Okay, people just... Anyways... It's going to be coming much, the shrill coming out of the left, coming out of Jewish-controlled media is going to be even more. But if you saw this Emily Gorsensky, she's like, she shows up, she thinks she's going to be defending the whole world against a bunch of Nazis. And of course, everybody she thinks is a Nazi is there because they see very well precisely what is going on inside of their country. They see these leftist liberal / Jewish I don't know what you want to call the Jewish, the back by the Jewish funding, at least, huh? But you see what's going on out there with the removal of monuments, with the attack of campus. I mean, my goodness, you've got like high schools saying that they're going to change, what do you call it? Change the advanced placement to allow for race and not merit. So basically a bunch of probably white kids are not going to be even to be partaking of the program because they're quote unquote white. So people are starting to see this left and right everywhere. You know, we're getting it. We literally, you in America for sure, not me so much here in the Middle East, but you're getting attacked everywhere. And to watch this woman, Ms. Gorsensky, and she's actually made a complete jackass of herself. She said, "Where are you? We're outnumbered. There's too many Nazis here. And where the heck are you?" She's actually cursing, okay? But where are you? What is going on here? And she wants to try to defend. I mean, come on. Once this beast, once this Western sleeping giant wakes up, I suspect we are going to see changes much faster than you can realize, only because Jewish media, by clamping down on what has been happening in the West for so many years, and I'm talking about decades upon decades, literally, that they have created now a situation that is, one, a pressure cooker, and two, existential. And for the Emily Gorsenskys out there that think they're going to go out there and they're going to defend the world against Nazis, well, you have something coming, because we've been doing this a long time. We've been laying our groundwork for a long time. Our numbers are continuing to grow. We see the failures of Jewish policies. We must stay focused on the failures of Jewish policies. All the riffraff side issues, we'll deal with them, but understand at the very core of everything is we must deal with the fact that this is essentially all come about because of Jewish programming in media, academia, pretty much that would be it. Media and academia are good enough starts. So folks, that is your Oy Vey moment. Again, it is brought to you by Werewolf Radio. Visit werewolfradio.com and heartlandonline.net, because that is the sponsor of the new Oy Vey moment. So thank you again going out to the new sponsor there. All right, I've got one other thing, and that's private sponsorships, everybody. It was a great week for The Fetch for Inside the Eye Live last week. We're very excited about what's happening. We've seen our traffic at the website up 100%. Now, it's not mind-boggling high, okay? I'm not getting that, but it's up 100% since we've made the changes to Inside the Eye Live. Now, we want to say something. There is a donations and sponsorship page now, and it's very clear. You can go to Inside the Eye Live, see the sponsorships and donations. This week, Claudius E., I'm not going to give last names out over the air. Claudius E., she sent a nice message. Appreciate your work, Fetch, and well done challenging that fella 2 weeks ago. Made me laugh. She said quite a bit more, but that's where we'll leave it. She sent a $15 donation from London in the United Kingdom. Peter O., he did not leave a comment, but he is coming to us from Ireland, and he sent $5. Burnett, out of, again, no message here in the note. She's coming to us from, I believe Burnett is a female. I'm going to have to assume that. I assume the listeners here aren't liberals, so you're not one of 40 other genders that these morons want to try to feed our way. Burnett, out of Noonan, Georgia, she sent a very generous donation of $50. And then Dion Werewolf, of course, sponsored the Oy Vey moment, which we let go at basically $5 a show for fun. So last week we had about $100 come through the door to help sponsor everything. That helped buy the telephone number. Again, 1-323-275-1314. That's 1-323-275-1314. And again, you can catch, that's the new listener line. We bought some very nice software that allows me to capture my digital camera so we can do some live streaming. We're going to go into production on that. Our first show is going to be this coming Monday. So guys, your donations are very, very, very important again. And no joke, appreciate it, because we want to start to expand perhaps Inside the Eye Live. And that means it's just costs more and takes more time. And if you appreciate the show and you have the means, heck, you know what? I'm not the ADL. I'm not asking for $50 million so we can go out there and fight anti-Semitism all day. And we are really the source of creating anti-Semitism. No, we're not doing that. I saw some other strange story this week. I forget even where I saw it, to be honest, but I just want to bring it up. Is not only have we had the fraud going on in the Jewish community with relative to Homeland Security, but you had that American teenager, if you recall. Literally, we've learned now that probably as many as 1,000 threats to Jewish synagogues, to Jewish infrastructure, if you want to call it that, to basically the state within the state that Jews like to see themselves. Over 1,000 calls that went out. And again, that's a lot of numbers, guys. Come on, 1,000 calls were actually done by Jews to Jews. And then Jews are using these Jews who are calling and making the threats as proof that anti-Semitism is on the rise and we need more money. We need to support Homeland Security. Give us $90, $100 million because we're getting all of these threats. And all the time, it's basically the Jewish glass broker paying kids out there to go out there and break all the glass so he can sell more glass at the retail level. That's what we're looking at right now within the Jewish community. We see all of these stunts and moves by the Jewish community and there's various factions and groups out there where they're trying to create quote-unquote anti-BDS legislation, which would then put people in jail because you don't support Israel or because you criticize Israel. They're saying that somehow our countries, whether it's the UK, France, Germany, Australia, the United States, they're out there saying something to the effect that, hey, because you criticize Israel, you're anti-Semitic. Well, that should never be a priority for us in our own countries. Look, if we're going to have a sovereign nation, it shall never, ever be subjected to the whims and wills of Jews, for one, and Israel, for two, because they're inseparable relative to political power. Let's not kid anybody. I saw another story coming out of D.C., and I'm like, Trump, 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 what are you doing, dude? And a lot, you know, we like Trump. My next guest does not like Trump, Brendan O'Connell. He's standing by. I understand he doesn't like Trump too much, but we like Trump. We like the change in the rhetoric. We like what we're seeing. We understand it's difficult to change things overnight, so we're a little bit more patient and pragmatic than perhaps others. They put out the word from the New York Post or the New York Times, I think of New York Times, that Trump isn't leaving military options off the table relative to Venezuela. I'm like, come on, dude. You're talking military action against North Korea, which will be a disaster for the Koreans. You're now talking about military. Everything is military. You know, the reality is, folks, our military, I'm talking about America now, and Canada too, really, and the UK. Our militaries are not our militaries anymore. Our militaries are basically serving, obviously, some corporate slash, I don't know, federal banking reserve, if you want to call it that, interest, but it's not serving us Americans. There's no point in us sending our military down to Venezuela. What are you going to do down in Venezuela? You can't even handle yourself really in Syria. You can't handle yourself in Iraq. And I saw Trump give a speech recently. He kind of put it out. He says, show me where we've won, guys. Yeah, show us where we've won. Really, tell us, where have we won? We haven't won anything in a long time. And that's because we're fighting for the wrong reasons. We're not fighting for things that are valuable to the American people in the United States. What's valuable to America in the United States, of course, is our homeland, as I hear people like Secretary of State Tillerson like to say. What's important is our homeland. And that is true for every country on this planet. It's your homeland. That's what's important. That's what you fight for. Now, relative to America, our homeland is secure. We have two very, very large bodies of water. Now, for those of you who haven't figured out geography yet, to mount an invasion across the Atlantic or to mount an invasion across the Pacific ain't ever going to happen to the Americans. You start focusing on internal enemies and start to rout. It's the Fed and O'Connell coming next. All right, everybody, welcome back. It's the Fetch Inside the Eye, live intelligent media for the politically aware right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Our guest is coming to us, I believe, from now Malaysia, Brendan O'Connell. He's billed here on some sites as a 40-year-old pro-Palestinian. He's probably a bit older than that now. Pro-Palestinian activist who is now who served a 3-year prison sentence for violating Australian laws intended to suppress white concerns. That coming from our friends over at the OccidentalObserver.net. Brendan O'Connell. Brendan, welcome to Inside the Eye Live.
Yeah, thanks, Dennis. And I like that. 40. Yeah, I'll take 40 instead of 46.
You're that old. This is that old of an article, huh? Yeah, you know, I know how you feel, man. I've been doing this for 6 years. So basically, you were apparently serving your sentence in Australia, and we just started Inside the Eye Live. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved in finding yourself at the loggerheads of Jewish power structures out there on the Australia and the world?
Yeah, it's a funny little old place. Well, thanks for having me on, Dennis. Just to clarify, I even hate the word activist. I mean, I use it myself because it's just sort of the easiest way to say things. I was never a pro-Palestinian activist per se. I had an interest in the region. I knew people that had lived in the region. I knew people who had been in the Russian Orthodox Christian Church there, the Abbot of Jerusalem. There was a whole range of reasons why, but it was just out of good conscience I turned up there that particular day to the protest. But Perth is a very isolated city, and I wasn't even going to go that morning, but I got up, I left, and we were very quiet. It was just a bunch of lapsed Catholics there, communists, softcore socialists, green left, but really nice people. We were chatting. I met Alex Wisson, the head of the Friends of Palestine, and it was just a very quiet day for a couple of hours, and then a confrontation began by some young 21-year-old Jewish Zionist activists affiliated with Habanim Dror and Chabad Lubavitch.
Just out of curiosity, who set that up? Were you kind of like ambushed, or did you do the ambushing?
Oh, no, he did the ambushing. He was photographing people. He was working for the Maccabean paper, he claimed. But he clearly knew who I was, I could tell. And he waited for me till the last. I thought he was affiliated with the group. And he photographed me. There was another guy, Daniel R.E. Lazarus, who had, like, quote-unquote, infiltrated the Friends of Palestine, and another guy, Timothy John Peach, who had tagged along with young Stanley Keyser. And he took my photo about 10 feet in front of me. Blatantly, it was done to provoke. And I went, that's a bit weird the way he did that. And then he made a big song and dance and said, what you're doing is disgusting. We're Jews from Melbourne, and walked off.
Yeah. Obviously, we always are humored at how Jews get to declare that unilaterally. It's like, who are you guys? You know, we don't twirl chickens to absolve our sins. So don't talk to us about what's disgusting. So what happened then? Basically, you obviously set up. Now, that I know happens a lot. I've been set up. Many of us have been set up. So you get set up by this Jewish kid. And then how did this escalate to the point to where you find yourself in prison?
Well, I took great objection to him running around taking everyone's photo, because you got to remember, he's a hardcore activist, Habanim Dror, Zionist Youth Group, Australasian Union of Jewish Students, the president, very, very active. And people keep saying he was young, a teenager. No, he was 21 years old and very politically active. I got my camera and said these exact words, excuse me, you Jews from Melbourne, you've been taking our photos. Why didn't you just come up to us, shake our hand, introduce yourself and give us your side of the story? So we started reasonably amicably, but as he talked, you know, I think we're all just a bit sick of the whole issue and sick of the whining, and, you know, it gets very frustrating having to try and talk sense to someone, you know, simple things, very simple things. And it just escalated, and he mentioned Holocaust, brought it up. I didn't even bring it up. He brought it up. And he was, if you watch the video, which is available online, you'll see him telling everyone we have to leave, the security's being called, just ridiculous things. And then he actually pushed the camera, I mean, slapped it back into my face. And that's when it got confrontational. And
so if he's insulting you, how is it that you had to go?
Oh, well, that's irrelevant. That's irrelevant to everything. But the point was, I used hurtful words. The words I got a year's jail for out of three were, okay, I said, you're a racist Jew. You have a religion of racism, hate, homicide, and ethnic cleansing.
Okay. So basically, you told the truth about what his race and his people are all about. Who took issue with it in Australia?
At the time, nothing. He went off. I then went across, calmed down, because I was really peeved, because I was feeling very good about just being very quiet and gentle and informing people about Talmud and other things, including the Israeli defense industry, Talpiot program to do with the BDS movement. None of these people were talking about it, so I thought I'll be very calm and come into the Friends of Palestine with no agenda per se, just to give this information. And I felt I'd been set up like an idiot, and I'd taken the bait to some degree. Now, when I went across the river, I did another, after I calmed down a bit, I did another piece where, and I used the words, as long as you continue to adhere to Rabbinic Pharisaic Judaism, your days are numbered, meaning, you know, once people find out, you're in deep trouble. And they took that quote and stated that was a very serious charge of Section 77, which is up to 14 years jail. So that was the initial second charge. But Basically, he was hurt. I uploaded the video May the 8th around, I think, and the police turned up on May the 12th, I think it was. Seven of them, tasers drawn, looking very edgy, and I was painting a roof.
Mm. So how bad is, I mean, this is going back 6-7 years, how bad is Jewish
8 years.
In 8 years now, how bad is, how strong, I should say, is Jewish power at suppressing Western expression right now? I mean, has it dissipated a little, or is it getting worse?
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? Technically, I'd say it's getting worse, but I could call myself an expert in this now, literally an expert. I've written a very good, under a lot of pressure, in a prison system, a high court synopsis, which people should read, and no one does. When I have given it to people like the senior international correspondent for Press TV, he was just, wow, he was totally blown away. The fact that the Israeli ambassador and deputy foreign minister turned up should tell people something. Look, it's really easy to avoid the legislation. If you want to, I could give you a 5-minute rundown on exactly what they're looking for.
Okay, yeah, why not? Maybe you're going to help somebody here.
All right, it's really simple. Generally, it's about a form of incitement or offense, meaning you have intended to deliberate. That means you have no interest in the truth. So the truth is not a defense. This furphy argument where people martyr themselves, which even I was doing till I worked out how the legal system works, which I learned very quickly, it's not about free speech. It has nothing to do with free speech. It's about intent. Officially, unofficially, it's also about your association. So they're going to have a good look into your background, and they will pursue you if you have any racial affiliations, white nationalist affiliations, national socialist affiliations, anything where they view you as in that mold. They will absolutely come after you. They were actually trying to back off me initially when they looked up my background. But I'm telling you, first off, if you are affiliated with any group like that, and that includes your private phone calls, they will go through your emails, and they will produce an unofficial document for the DPP. You won't know about it. It won't be a classic investigation like that. Then you are probably going to be in trouble.
Brendan, if you went out and got discovery, they're not going to include this as part of their discovery.
Absolutely not. No, this is the thing too. You think it's all about rules of court. There are no rules. They do whatever they damn well please. And it's always been like that. But the other thing is simply this, is to couch yourself and the way you move into the issue very carefully, not emotional. See, someone like a Kevin MacDonald, who, if you know, knowing his background, I didn't realize how you would say white nationalist groups, he uses the term white race enough. He gets away with a lot in term because he is an academic and he uses very non-emotional language. Right. And that's why he can get it. Well, I mean, I know he has lost tenure and other things, but in general, they even note in the criticisms or in the descriptions of the legislation and how it's operating in Perth and elsewhere around the world, and that piece of literature is called So Far, So Good, an analysis of legislation in Australia. It says they're actually worried because if someone couches an argument in the right terms, such as the positive aspects of gassing all Jews, if you couched it in enough academic terms, you could potentially get away with doing it. So if you understand, it's how you present the information. If you're screaming and frothing at the mouth, or you use terms like I did, your days are numbered, then you're going to get yourself entrapped in the legislation if you're violent in any way or aggressive in any way or emotional in any way, or you're affiliated with any groups such as the Australian Nationalist Movement in Australia or any group you could think of, Combat 18, the usual Hollywood stuff. Mm-hmm. So if you avoid all that and you go about things in a more academic way, understand truth is not the debate here. It's incitement and your intent. The key word is intent. So like a knife is not illegal. If I go in public with a knife and I'm a chef, then it's clear they can make strong inferences that the reason I've got a knife on me is because I'm a chef. If I go into the street and I'm a member of a gang and I'm covered in tattoos, the police can then infer that, in fact, my intent with the knife is to obviously cause physical damage. And that's the way they view the legislation, intent. So they're looking at you, your behavior, and your affiliations. So if you limit all that and approach things in a genuinely peaceful way to say, this is an issue in the public interest, my own personal lawful interests and the public interest. And once you grasp those terms, you'll understand that the legislation, particularly if you couch it in the terms of national security, as I do under that TELPIOP program information and other things, then you really already have a powerful way of, even if they bring in such legislation, say in the United States, you have powerful ways to just bypass it very, very easily.
Okay, so essentially, I guess I get it, but I don't get where you're really going there. You keep saying non-emotional. Give us like an example, like just one type of legal argument that you might use.
Well, for instance, it's all in presentation. You've got to understand the legislation is not it's airy-fairy. They're just using it as a weapon to go after certain people. For instance, if you went and couched your terms say the Talmud. Now, we can clearly show in an argument, if you present the argument non-emotionally, with no affiliations, that it's quite clear that when you describe someone like a Rabbi Avadia Yosef, who moves in the highest circles of power, then it's very easy to create the argument that not only is he infecting his entire society, he's at a high level, he's not marginalized, he's mainstream, whether you're Ashkenazi or Sephardic, they're equally insane. He's saying about the Goyar as slaves, he's quoting from his holy books, he's saying we're subhuman, we're not animals, and we can then argue this guy is not some obscure person. He's a top Sephardic rabbi in a state where the same views are expressed by the deputy defense minister, the Avigdor Liebman and others, and academics, and Hannah Kasher, and all this. We can show clearly that throughout all of Israeli society, they are mouthing these same concepts, including, you know, killing the parents of Palestinian resistance fighters, because that fits in with the concept of Amalek or Amalekites. Now, you can clearly argue this stuff with no problems whatsoever. How could anyone possibly take you to court on that when you can clearly show this is a matter in the public interest?
Yeah, I've listened to a little bit of what you've been doing. I actually kind of like your legal reasoning. I think you've got a solid basis here on how you're approaching it from a legal point of view. Obviously, you've had to deal and adapt, you know, the way they've treated you out there. So, but I like some of your legal reasoning here. That a lot of this makes a lot of sense to me. You were talking also about Canada, the same type of legal reasoning up in Canada, because the Canadians seem to be under a lot of stress and duress. And you're saying something, I forget the way you worded in a video, something to the effect that, you know, you have, you basically put forward the idea that it's very rational to feel this way. We're not, you know, it's not irrational having these feelings of quote-unquote distrust or hatred of Jews.
Exactly. See, but the problem with me is I could have won my case so easily. But you have to understand, I couldn't get the lawyers. They were just trying to take a very simple approach that I was to just sort of apologize and say, look, I didn't mean to do that, and I'm really sorry. And I said, like hell. I said, plus I was political. I wanted to get this stuff on the record, and the lawyers were resisting all along, and I was getting majorly harassed, because part of the thing is, believe me too, that the police actually came to me and were trying to back off, but he threatened me, and I had my back up. Now, if I could go back in time, I assure you I would never behave the way I did, because now I've learned a very hard lesson, but I'm grateful for it. I know now how the legal system works, and I know how to respond. I didn't know back then. I was too emotionally immature. But if you can remove emotions and appear calm and rational and reasoned and go in, preferably with a lawyer who'll work for you. I mean, Ernst Zundel, rest in peace, actually had a lawyer working for him when he went to court, and he had a lot of supporters, and he had money and so on. I was getting majorly harassed, and I was surrounded by half-learned. I had some good people around me, but a lot of them were very sketchy. And I was under a lot of pressure. And, of course, I just didn't know enough in the courtroom, and I was getting hammered. But they wouldn't let me present any evidence to say, listen, this will allow the jury to gauge my intent. They'll be able to ascertain my state of mind and make inferences as to my intentions by showing clearly, oh, this guy just got a bit angry because, oh, look. And then, I mean, I even offered Frederick Tobin to get on the stand. He wasn't interested. Him and Peter Hartong had no interest whatsoever in coming to that trial. And he took off to America and said, oh, I'll just pretend to be sick and I'll see if I can get there when I get back. See, now, these are opportunities to have what I thought would be a calm and rational human being on the stand to put forward that, look, we're rational people, but we're getting very upset with the way we're being treated. Now, this is the way you weave a narrative to a jury. Unfortunately, that never happened with my case, because a whole combination of factors. But certainly, you know, I've been very open about my own culpability, the way I reacted to certain things. But look, I was a deer in the headlights. I was warned I would get hammered. And I said, don't be silly. This isn't Africa, mate. This isn't the Middle East. This is a first world parliamentary democracy. Well, after 3 years in jail, an 18-month lead up to the trial, I learned just how corrupt a modern Western country can be. If this had happened in Iran, it would be front page news on the New York Times.
Probably true. Isn't it kind of strange, though, to like you and to me and to the listeners that it's a one-way street? It always seems to be Jews imposing themselves on the rest of our community and not the other way around.
Look, you're right, and I don't want to sound like a whiny Jew because that's all I've done is whine lately, and I've had to really snap out of it. Let's stop whining about them and understand they come from a legal perspective. They always.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no, of course. We're just, it's a live show. We have callers calling in, a lot of things.
So
you're okay with taking phone calls, I assume?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, 321 area code. Hi, you're on the air with Brendan O'Connell.
How you doing today?
Good. You know, welcome. New numbers working, huh?
Yeah.
Cool.
Not to be disrespectful at all, but I don't know how we're ever going to get anything done if we don't speak like a human being when somebody commits a crime and be disgusted about it. If we're going to just preach out like Kevin McDonald does, you know, I don't know where you can go with that, man, because it's never going to work. Can you imagine Hitler rising to power like Kevin McDonald? Come on, man. You need to get more people to be disgusted when they talk about this because it's absolutely poisonous and it's destroying our world and we better talk like it is. And that's all I have to say. I didn't mean, this is me talking, not Fetch and not Brendan O'Connell. This is me. That's what I believe and that's what we should do. This pussy talk has gone on far too long. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the
Amen, brother. I understand how he feels. Listen, yeah, I did get like that, and it cost me 3 years jail. So if you want to get emotional, they're very good at it, and they deliberately provoke you. Why would the chief Sephardic rabbi get up and say this stuff?
Brendan, you've got a lot of like a rumble in the background. I don't know if it's your microphone hitting something or what, but you got a lot of rumble, and you'll probably not like the feedback.
Wait a minute. How's that? Is that any better?
Well, that's so far. Yeah, it comes and goes, but you won't like it.
I know what it is. It's the air conditioning blowing on me. I can't do much.
That sounds kind of like that might be some going across the window.
Is that any better?
Well, so far. We just don't want you to go through an hour.
I look like a rabbi.
You know what I have to do, Brendan? I'm in Amman, and it's 92 here today, 90 when I went on air, and I shut all the windows, all the air conditioners, everything goes off. And I take the shirt off. I know you girls don't want to necessarily see that, but I take the shirt off, and I just sweat through 3 hours of intelligent media for the politically aware.
Sacrifice.
Yeah, you know, you got a production here. But the sentiments of the caller there, you know, we got to a point now, Brendan, where really people need to, although you can't be emotional, you got to get angry.
Well, that's normal, but I'm just telling you, it's understandable. See a therapist. I use the court as a therapist and the police, and it cost me 5 raids.
Certainly, we can have rational anger.
I agree, but it doesn't matter. You get in front of the jury, and they're going to ascertain you a psychiatric evaluation. They're going to see you as the judge says to me, quote, I have a, quote, irrational hatred of Jewish people.
It sounds to me like what Jews are saying is that there needs to be counter laws that Jews have irrational hatred of white people and just start putting them to trial.
Well, look, I agree, and there's ways to do it. But I'm just saying, if you want to win, separate your therapy and your emotions, which I understand completely. Believe me, you're one of them. I'm sick. I can't. One of the reasons I focused on Israel so much in my own sort of political way, I don't like injustice. I don't like unfairness. Many people are like that. The caller's obviously like that. He's had enough, and it's totally understandable. But understand, too, that they deliberately provoke this as well because they want to appear very rational.
Yes, they do. It's basically they've taken the troll environment and they've taken into real life or the troll world of the net is really Jewish real life. They really do provoke it, and people need to start to understand that.
Michael Hoffman wrote a great book called The Merchants of Venom and how they deliberately provoke this. And the point is to say, we are rational, you are irrational. You're an animal, we're human beings. But I understand the call of sentiment, particularly if you're from the United States. I mean, you've been humiliated. I mean, your country. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu just came out and said, go to hell, we're teaming up with India and China and we're dropping you. I mean, dear God, the arrogance that they would do that. And I mean, what the hell's wrong with the United States Marine Corps?
Yeah, they just got a huge, huge victory where we're sanctioning Russia to the teeth here. You spent time in Iran. Tell us a little bit about Iran. What was it like for you in Iran? You're going back again, 5 years ago to Iran, I guess, huh?
No. I was in Iran up to January 31st this year. I spent 10 weeks there.
Well, only 10 weeks. I thought you were there a long time. So you spent
No.
I heard that you had spent like years. So, okay, you were there 10 weeks ago. What was it like 10 weeks ago?
No, I was there for 10 weeks. I was last there January 31st, 2017. Look, it's a beautiful place. I love the people.
Really? Okay,
if I was there for a holiday, fantastic. I had a very bad experience with the people that bought me. The first time, it seemed the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. The senior international correspondent, Hamid Fadaroli, said, well, what do you expect, Brendan? It's a third world country. And then told me that Press TV were probably embezzling his funds and they were incompetent, which just set me off. It was the worst pollution they'd had in their history. I didn't have much money. And I thought, oh, to hell with this. I'm just getting out of here. It's another disaster. That was the first trip. And then I came back to Malaysia. And 4 days later, I went back under an invitation from a lawyer, an Iranian lawyer based in the United States. So without going into too much detail, because it would take a week, the second one was a little better, but I just was isolated a lot. They deliberately kept me away from people. And by the time the lawyer got there 6 weeks later, I wasn't particularly happy. And if I'd had money, I would have left at that stage again. I found who I was dealing with or not dealing with.
Being marooned sucks, doesn't it?
Sorry?
I said being marooned sucks.
and you're stuck in Podunk Khansa, 500 kilometers southwest of Tehran. Now, it is a beautiful place. I mean, if you're writing a book with your gas stove, with your tea, your chai, and your dry bread, you'd love it. I mean, it's beautiful. I don't want to appear ungrateful, but I was there on business. I'd had 8 years of hell. I wanted to get this thing finished, and I presumed I was at the pinnacle. I was at the Super Bowl, and I had on my gridiron gear. I had my football, and I walked out onto the field, and everyone was playing cricket. I found they barely talk about Israel. They just go on and on about Saudi and the Gulf states to the point where I stood up and said, how effing long, I don't mean to swear, but I was that angry. How long are you going to go on about this? How long? I said, is this helping? Yeah. This is not helping. I said, I know all your reasons and your rationale. They continuously went on how they had a beautiful 3,000-year Persian culture and the Gulf states were constructs of British intelligence and on and on. It was almost like infantile. And then they said, Israel is the problem. Fix Israel, we'll fix everything else. And I just found they resisted me at every turn, didn't want to talk about Orthodox Judaism, were in a panic. I mean, a panic if I was going to insult the Jews.
And I spend a lot of time in Saudi and it's the same there. It just boggles my mind, the fear that the Jewish people have been able to really bring upon the world about it, just talking about them. It sometimes amazes me.
I think if everyone looks at Iraq and Syria, I guess that's why.
Well, yeah, I guess. But still, it's irrational because we're destroying our world for basically a very hyper minority of people that just don't care about humanity. And that's the way I see it.
Well, they care about their humanity, but just to let you know that Iran is not under sanctions. It's not under sanctions. Iran's booming along quite nicely, thank you.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, I mean, the West, the problem we have with America, okay, I don't know about Australia, but here in America, we just kind of joke that as soon as Jews are unhappy about something, they want to do a BDS on somebody. And the second you want to BDS Israel, they want to outlaw and criminalize you.
Well, yeah, but let's not whine about it. Let's fix it. And there's a way to fix it. And the trouble is they've got us in a state where we're just so angry and fed up and frustrated that when it's so easy to fix, if you focus on those twin pillars, their racism, their hate, and also the intelligence angle and the infiltration of the entire high technology sector. And I understand you're in the electronic communications sector.
Yes.
I didn't know that till recently. then you begin to understand, let's just fix it. And I believe we can fix it very easily. And this is why they hammered me and literally chased me out of the damn country in the end. They were not going to let me get out on the street with my banners and my flyers and team up with. And they even said, a prison officer said, they're worried about you because you're charismatic, you're an organizer, you get people motivated. Just said, just watch yourself, be careful. You know, just give it away, Brendan. And I said, like hell.
All right, Brent McConnell, everybody. But right after this, it's the Fetches I Like. All right, everybody, welcome back. It's the Fetch Inside the Eye, live intelligent media for the politically aware. For those of you going to pick this up in the archives, it's August 12, 2017. Local time here in Amman is 6:35. Our guest here in hour two, Brendan O'Connell. Brendan, tell us a little bit about some of your web properties. How can people reach out to you?
I've got a blog and a website.
Okay.
But the blog is if you just Google search. Sorry, there's a really heavy feedback. If you just Google isolatebutpreserve.blogspot.com, that's my blog. And my name, Brendan O'Connell, B-R-E-N-D-O-N, and O'Connell, O apostrophe C-O-N-N-E-L-L. And also, email is quite simple, meeting@boc.rocks. So that's my initials, Brendan O'Connell, BOC. So meeting@boc.rocks.
Mm-hmm. Based on the chat room, people are enjoying at least the first half hour here, so that's a good start, right? You know, Brendan, we have to apologize. You know, you and I were competing with the rallies right now going on in Charlottesville, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
The big audience, there's a lot of people going out to see this. We've had torchlight parades last night. I don't know what it is with us, the Europeans. We like our torchlight parades. But they were out last night, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 4,000 strong. There's a big rally right now as we speak. And so it's going down. There's a lot of interest of that, obviously, in the United States. So hopefully we can start to turn things around. You're not a big fan of Dugin. From what I understand, you have some issues with this Eurasian project, which is part of China.
Well, I can understand his reasons, and why wouldn't he? Good luck to him. But why are Americans supporting their own destruction?
Well, let's talk about Dugin, though, first. We know Dugin is kind of like on the seedier side of things. I'm going to support that point. He went out and he destroyed some, like, his European youth group after the 2004 Orange Revolution, went out and destroyed a bunch of Holodomor monuments. Of course, that would directly reflect back on the Jewish community. So what's your opinion then with the Dugin influence within, let's say, the Putin administration?
Look, I've been half with Putin for a long time. I want to be impressed by him. I had skin in the game. I'd been hammered. So I thought, look, someone's hammering my enemy. I thought in Russia, there's obviously a huge awareness of, people like a Solzhenitsyn and 400 years together. You can talk on the trains openly, even though there are laws that Putin put in. I'm not sure how they maintain their exact balance, but they tend to do it pretty well between Russians and Orthodox Christians and even atheists and Jews or whatever description. But you've got to look objectively at Putin. And when I came back from Iran, when I realized something was very wrong, when I went to Iran, I was expecting to be in a place where Israel was central. And I realized that, wait a minute, this is a sold-out revolution. There's luxury cars everywhere. There's obviously a great disparity between the rich and the poor. The Ayatollah Khomeini is living in the wealthiest part of Tehran. I don't want to be too critical, but, you know, as a spiritual leader, everyone criticizes the Pope. Well, maybe the Ayatollah should be like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and live in South Tehran or something. But, you know, that's just me. I'm a bit of a purist. And there's building cranes everywhere. There just didn't seem to be something right. And when you look at Putin, you've got to study him. And I looked at it and I wanted to ignore it because I wanted a strong man. I was in that psychological profile. But when you study Putin and particularly his relationship with Netanyahu and Israel, it is so in bed. And the fact that he is surrounded by Jewish oligarchs, and he's been surrounded from a very long time, and I'd even argue that he's been groomed from a very, very early age for his role somewhere along the line.
And then, of course, if we take this philosophy, this idea, though, and we expand that into virtually every other European and even America, give us a country where we don't see this phenomenon going on.
Well, absolutely. But if you've got Putin with his well-known, you know, his bank accounts, I mean, all these Jewish oligarchs are all pouring their money into the City of London banking system, the Swiss banking system, the German banking system. You know, he's just another, in my view, he's just another product of them all. Rouhani, Putin, Netanyahu,
How do you equate, though, with a lot of the efforts for, and of course we Americans need to do the exact same thing, by the way, to begin repatriating money. A lot of calls for people to, hey, look, you got to start repatriating your money, bring it back to Russia. You know, we see a lot of this calls from the Russian federal government. So
But the point is, he's in bed with Netanyahu. They're friends. They're actual friends. Look at them. Russia doesn't give a damn about Muslims. Hey, look, he's a communist through and through. All the talk. I don't give a damn what he says. I give a damn about what he does. And the bottom line is, the Russians love him because they want bacon fat and they want porridge on the table. Completely understandable. I mean, they went through hell post-Soviet. I mean, they went through hell through the Soviet, and they went through hell prior to that, and they went through hell after it. Now with Putin, they have a renewed sense of destiny, they have a renewed sense of patriotism, but it's just, in my opinion, and many others, a cover. It's the same people running the show. How can you say when every single person Putin hangs around is a freaking Jewish oligarch, a Russian Jewish oligarch? How can you ignore that? How could you ignore that? Every single one.
I guess it's kind of like America, you know. We can do no policy without having a Jew at the figurehead.
That's the narrative they weave, isn't it? Oh, you can't avoid it, everyone. Come on.
Well, yeah, that's the whole point, is that we have to rationally understand that if we have problems, those making the decisions ought to be responsible for those problems. And everywhere we look, we're looking at Jews making the decisions, so therefore Jews are the problem.
So why doesn't Putin just come out and say, have you looked at that, Talmud? Look, how easy would it be for us to clearly show this is a problem? The culture, the heritage, particularly that Orthodox Judaism and the Talmud, Shulchan Aruch, that particular brand, that virulent brand of anti-Gentile, anti-the other. I mean, it's lunacy. It makes National Socialism look like a choir boy's picnic. Now, why wouldn't people get out there and have a go at that? We've seen what happens when people offend Jews. Just look at Saddam Hussein. Just look at Saddam Hussein. Look at JFK. That's what happens to you when you start to mess with the structure. You don't become a billionaire when you take them on. There's only one thing that happens to you when you really take them on, and Saddam was doing that. There's only one country I know of who seems to have handled it reasonably cleverly, and that's where I am now, Malaysia, under Dr. Mahathir Mohamad and others here. They have gone out after Israel and done conferences. They lost two aircraft, I think, because of it, that... at that stage.
Yeah, yeah, I may have a point there. MH370 and MH17, I think, both aircraft.
But I'm telling you, you get hammered. I mean, they said we're gonna salt the earth with depleted uranium, just like the Romans would do, as an example. That's what happens to you when you mess with us. We know what happens to you. Look what happened to me. They came out viciously against me. I was in shock, and I'm not easily shocked. They stalked me, my family. We had 5 suspicious deaths. I mean, it was vicious, man. I was a wreck, and I still am a wreck. And I've tasted their wrath. So I'm not real sure about these people that we say are going to rescue us when they've got billion-dollar bank accounts.
I have a question for you, though. You know, we can easily go this way and say everything is bad, 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 but we see changes are happening. I happen to feel that we've got a lot of smart people working for us also. Also, it's not all doom and gloom. Otherwise, we already lost the war, okay, is the way I would see it. And some people say you already did lost the war. You lost already, Fetch. Look how many wars you've been. You went to World War I, World War II, Vietnam, North Korea, Iraq. Look, you've already lost. You know, so I understand that position too. But when you look at people like a Putin and a Trump, they look like they're trying to do what's better for their country. And there's a position here, Brendan, about personnel. We can't get the personnel into positions of power overnight. And the infiltration has been so strong that
Dennis,
shouldn't we allow for some time to allow personnel to start the
plan? Dennis, Trump is groomed, a product of the very same people you say you want to get out of power. How is Trump going to do that? This is a psychological warfare operation. If we keep looking to the top to save us, we're going to lose every time. Every time. We can win this if we approach it in a moral and ethical way as a criminal investigation. Let me give you one example. I rang the office of the Department of Homeland Security and made a complaint against Israel and Jewish synonyms. And I recorded that call. I'm going to put it up. Has anyone else thought to do that? That one simple little act, activist activity?
No.
Anywhere.
Yeah, 201 area code. You're on the air with Brendan O'Connell.
Hi, great show. Always try to listen to it Saturday mornings.
Thank you.
New Jersey, and my name is Dan. I've noticed that on my computer that the phone number is no longer available to call in. I have
Well, you know, Dan, listen, Dan, we've changed the number. Make a note of it. 1-323-278-1314.
Oh, I have to get to my temple.
Yeah. Okay. So,
I mean, what you say about the Jewish people, my is why for 2,000 years nobody liked them? One night when the ship got sailed around the world, nobody wanted to talk to them. Nobody would let them in, not even this country. Our founders didn't want them in. I mean, you know, it's, okay, let me have that number again, please.
Yeah, it's plus one in America, of course.
323-275-1314.
Correct.
Good work. I mean, it's a great show. Great show.
Thanks so much, Dan. Thanks for calling. We're going to keep rolling because we only have Brendan for another 10 minutes or so. So we're going to keep rolling. Thanks so much. So Brendan, we agree on the activism you got to fight. But at the same time, have you seen a time now where the rhetoric has changed? I mean, do you see anything positive at all from your point of view?
Yeah, I see what they're doing now via Trump is a clear indication of how scared they are. They had to put one of their boys up because grassroots knowledge. What was Trump's job? Trump is a psychological warfare operation. He is a counterinsurgency. They saw that via those algorithms. You must study that Cambridge Analytica, Google Analytics, Facebook, and how they're sewing this together. Cambridge Analytica bragged that they were giving the talking points to Trump. Every one of those spontaneous things he said, whether it was via a tweet or via his mouth, was completely rehearsed. There wasn't a single thing that came out of his mouth that wasn't rehearsed and given to him by Cambridge Analytica after they analyzed data. Hourly data. That's how controlled and contrived Trump was. You're going to have to deal with it. We just did a video about it where we touched on it recently. So once you grasp just how sophisticated they are running this counterinsurgency, pretend we're Guatemala or Nicaragua, because they've taken all those techniques and they're applying them right now in this campaign. Everything you see is a lie. It's designed to channel you into a safe paddock, like a farmer herding the sheep into prepared paddocks, so they can control and manage this emerging grassroots activism, which has said we've had enough. And they are channeling it as we speak. I mean, Putin has just come out and said we are going to look after Israel. Israel has said we don't want to have America look after us anymore. We're going to go with Russia. They announced it over 2 years ago. Now, I ask you, what do you need to tell you that they're not all working together? And when I am a trillionaire banker, you can't defeat them by waiting for one of their people. I'm sorry to be so black and white, because believe me, I wanted to believe it was room to maneuver at the top. There isn't any. I've come to that conclusion just in the last 3 months. There's no room for maneuver at the top. We have to do it. And there are good people in the system. I met them, from police, prison officers, military people, intelligence people, but even politicians. I've had very positive response from politicians. Trump is not a friend. He's getting talking points from a literal intelligence agency masquerading as a private company called Cambridge Analytica, which is affiliated with Google Analytics and Facebook. And they bragged, we know more about you than your best friend just by your usage of emoticons. That's how accurate it is. And we don't have the time to go deep into Trump, but you only have to look at who he's surrounded by, his history, his clear narcissism and his attitudes, and the fact he has no sense of humor whatsoever. He cannot take criticism, none of that material. And there are strong indications he's been compromised by the Jeffrey Epstein, his regular trips on his aircraft. You can't ignore the company someone's keeping. And I'm sorry, but this whole alt-right movement is contrived and managed by Robert Mercer, a Jewish stockbroker and the first man, a genius with computer science, who started that first fast trading supercomputers. That's who's running the alt-right movement and moving all those people into Charlottesville as we speak. And people are going to say, oh, but what are we ever going to do if we can't do anything? I'm sorry, you've got to stop looking for people from the top to herd you into a pack and manage you when we have enough information.
But nobody's, you know, if you get thousands of people, do you think they're being, like, consciously saying, gee, this Robert Mercer guy is herding me here? Or are they saying they're genuinely concerned and they're going to go try to do something and make your voice
known? You are being channeled down what this white nationalist, the white race stuff, so you can be marginalized. You can't take the white race argument to the housewives and the managerial class and your local congressman, your local senator, your local police officer, your local, ring up. I just made a complaint to the Department of Homeland Security. He was all ears. I was cut off after about 2 minutes, but it's a great bit of video. Has anyone done that? I did that to my Australian version over 3 years ago. I've had a real effect. I've had replies from the head of New Zealand intelligence, Sir Chris Finlayson. I've had ministers call me personally for 30 minutes ex-special forces commanders who are his friends, James McMahon. I've had a lot of success, people may not realize, but I haven't had it by being a member of what is quote-unquote a, you know, no one knows the difference between a genuine, honest white nationalist or even, I've got a friend who's a national socialist. He says, I'm a national socialist. I'm not a Hitler groupie. Now, these are very rational people I've met, and they genuinely don't hate other races, but it doesn't matter. You're giving stuff to the enemy. The reason I can reach across is because, the establishment know my real views, they know my emails, they know my phone calls, they know what I'm about. But two, you cannot use these arguments. When they push you into that white race along racial lines, you have lost. That is a compound that they control. It is their number one method of encasing you in a subculture and controlling you.
So when you look at people like Swedes, we're very, very big in Sweden, where we bring on their national socialists, yeah, they're boxed. We kind of agree with that in just rational observation here. But what do you tell these people that say, look, your country is being overrun by Somalia, by Kenyans, by Eritreans? How are they supposed to feel? Are they supposed to go off into some non-identifiable soup and say, let's fight from this non-identifiable soup? Or what's
but
your
they're not fighting. They're not fighting at all. They're just bitching and moaning. Oh, there's black people in my country. Stop moaning like a B-I-T-C-H and start doing something. Ring the Office of Homeland Security. Hand out flyers, but do so in a moral and ethical manner. And understand this is a criminal investigation, and the problem is Jewish power, political Zionism, and Israel. Identify it and make strategies. Just as if you were a general, a German general on the Eastern Front, you look for weaknesses and you go after them on their racism, their hate, and you educate your local population. Reach out to the communities. Reach out to the subcultures. Find the non-lunatic, mentally ill and drug-affected refugees who are being herded into gangs and being used by the local police, whether in Sweden or elsewhere. They've been given cocaine. They've been given firearms by the police, I might add, to do what they're doing. But reach out to the more rational people, the ones with families, and understand where they come from. They're desperate. They didn't blow up their countries. We, quote-unquote, we did with our governments. We blew them up. So let's have some compassion too. Yes, but if some guy, whether he's black, white, or brown, from Somalia or wherever he's from, touches my girlfriend, yeah, I'm gonna crack him one. But not because of he's a different colour. It's because of his behaviour. And then I want to go to the politicians and the police commissioners who allowed this to happen. And above all, I want to identify the enemy and reach out to people, including members of the Jewish community who are upset as well, because there are. I've met them. And many of them are trapped. They can't speak out. They're in a gang. And so many of them get killed. They get intimidated. They get hacked and arrested, just like we do. But you must reach out as a criminal investigation. And unfortunately, I understand the sentiment of people. It's so easy to get angry. You're talking about Mr. Anger here. You're talking to him now. But I had to learn the hard way over 8 years. If you let your emotions get the better of you, they win. And we must get together in a real, genuine movement of peace and solidarity along the lines of character and values and decency, and forget this race thing for now. If you want to go move to Idaho, Coeur d'Alene, and retire in your white paradise, do it. I'm all for it. It's your freedom and liberty, and I really believe in that. But if you're going to denigrate and call people names, and I'm just saying you can walk and chew gum. So, yes, I understand your sentiment to someone in Sweden. I have a friend there, and he tells me stories. He can't even go to the damn shopping center. I understand that, but you've got to get out of that and try and form communications with people to actively engage in the political process, and people are not engaging. Jewish power engages in the political process. They don't bitch and whine. They get business done, and we've got to stop whining.
Well, hell, that's a heck of a monologue you just threw out there, Brendan.
It's called coffee. It's called coffee.
What time is it there? You know, we only got like about 1 minute to go. So why don't you just tell people where they can find you and how to reach out to you and all that kind of fun stuff, because I think we got like 1 minute left.
Again, I have a website as well, but I don't visit. See, it's handled by a friend in Sweden. My website is pretty easy. It's my initials, but people get confused because the domain's not .com. It's Rocks, R-O-C-K-S. So it's BOC.ROCKS. And that is my website, and my email is meeting@boc.rocks. And I'm also on Facebook under Brendan O'Connell. I'll try and get back there. And also isolatebutpreserve.blogspot.com.
And that's about perfect timing, everybody. Brendan O'Connell, everybody. Look, go follow some of his links that he just gave out. Brendan, thanks so much for coming on to Inside the Eye Live.
Thanks, Fetch. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All righty. Take care. Have a good evening, though.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. That's Brendan O'Connell. Back with more right after this. Miriam Al-Fatah. And it's the Fetch, as I triple task here. I'm not multitasking. I'm like triple tasking, quadruple tasking. let's see. Where is that darn thing here? It's one of these. I think it's that one. There you go. Hi. It's the Fetch, everybody. Inside the Eye Live. Intelligent media for the politically aware. Again, today's date is what? August 12th.
The 12th.
Yeah, August 12th, 2017. Our guest, Miriam Al-Fatah, I believe is her nom de guerre, and she has a website called Libya Against Superpower Media. She spent her life and childhood, I guess, in Libya, and she's here to discuss with us today some of the ongoings that led up and perhaps into the Libyan overthrow of the Gaddafi overthrow, I should say, and then on into some of the issues that we have going on today. First of all, it's Miriam. Am I correct on that one?
Yes, you are correct.
Ah,
thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks
on your radio show.
Thanks for coming. It's a busy day today. We're flowing going pretty fast. Guys, again, join us in the chat room, InsideTheEyeLive.com. That's InsideTheEyeLive.com. Click on the live chat button, and that will get you in the door there. Again, we'd like to repeat, we do have new phone call-in numbers. That's 1-323-275-1314. That's 1-323-275-1314. Remember, it is listener-sponsored and supported. So, guys, make your way to the donation site over there at freedomslips.com to help keep the network up and running. Hi, Miriam. Welcome to Inside the Ally. You're officially...
Hi. Hi.
You know, I was in, just to give you some insight, I've been living here in Jordan for 10 years, spent some time in Iraq, met the government, went to Saddam's house, know a lot of people in the royal palaces in the various areas here. And I remember the Libyan war. We covered the Libyan war a little bit because we had a lot of Libyans coming here. They managed somehow to dump like $400 million into the central bank here in Jordan, and that money disappeared like probably within 6 to 9 months, something like that. So I had a little bit of people tell me about what's going on in Libya, but to have you here is kind of fun because, you know, it's a topic we do cover a lot, is the Middle East. But you grew up, I understand, is that correct?
I was born and raised there in Libya, in Tripoli, actually. Libya... Let me say something about Jordan. The time in 2011, when Libyans came over, most of them were anti-Gaddafi.
That I believe.
Actually, quite a few of my relatives flew to Jordan and stayed there the whole time of the war because they were against him for whatever reason they thought they were, although they were working with the Gaddafi. And that's the funny thing is that a lot of Libyans who were anti-Gaddafi were working in the government or in national companies which belong to the Zamahiriya. And that surprised me a lot. It surprised me also a lot of my relatives that they were against him. Although,
how about your dog? Was your dog a supporter, or was your dog also against Gaddafi?
My dog was. She was a supporter.
Right?
Yeah, I will try. I will try. She's
like,
a bit.
Give me food, huh?
No, she's already eaten, but she's jealous.
There you go. Now, where are you located right now? Just to give people.
In Europe.
Are you in London? Where are you at?
South Europe.
South. Okay, no problem.
Yeah.
But in the South. So basically, you grew up in Libya. When I understand that as you were a child, Gaddafi really wasn't in power yet. He came into power a few years later, is that correct?
He came in power in 1969. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was 10 years old. I was already going to a private school in Libya. It was called Tripoli College. And then I stayed till 1971, where the teachers, for whatever reason at that time, they had to leave, because we had quite a lot of English teachers in that school, plus Arabic, of course. Mm-hmm. And then I went to the American Oil Company school for 1 year. Then I left for London, for England rather. Went to a boarding school, finished there, went to college. Went back to Libya around the early 80s.
How many youth like yourself found yourself leaving Libya and getting Western educations during this period?
Quite a lot, actually. Quite a lot. Let's put it this way. We were the lucky ones. My dad, even before Gaddafi, before the revolution, he was a businessman, a self-made businessman. He had the financing that he could send me to a private school in Libya. Till 1969, let me remind you that practically 80% of the population was illiterate.
And that's something Americans really don't grasp in the West here. Much of the Middle East, not just Libya, but really we're dealing with societies that were largely this Bedouin mindset
exactly.
A generation and a half ago. Heck, you can still go to parts of Amman and still see the guys living in the tents with
exactly,
the camels
exactly.
And the goats out there and herding the goats, mm-hmm. sometimes the goats right through the middle of downtown Amman here. And people mm-hmm. really grasp that. The difficulty it is to raise a country from a Bedouin point of view to some type of semblance of modernity, for whatever that means, in a generation or two, and they think it's easy, and it's really not, is it?
It's not. I'll tell you a funny story. I was must have been about 8-9 years old, I think, and there was this private club with a swimming pool and the beach, of course, and everything. And my parents used to drive there. I would see a tent. Every time we would go by, a tent, an antenna for the television inside the tent, and a Mercedes parked outside the tent. And I was wondering. And I asked my parents, I said, who are these people that they are living in the tent? They said, they're the Libyans. They're living there. I said, why can't they go and live in a house? So that's the way they're living. And I said, well, okay, what's this with the Mercedes? A very, not the American ones, the ones that, you know, that they're about 4 or 5 meters, but a normal Mercedes. And I said, what's with the car? I mean, if he's a nomad or whatever, he should have a horse or a donkey or a camel. I said, no, they're rich. You see, before 1969, there were practically 10 or 15 families who were very rich in Libya. The rest of the country was very poor. Plus, of course, we had the illiteracy, which was a big thing, because girls wouldn't go to school. I was one of the lucky ones that I went to school, and actually one of my aunts, who we don't have a big difference of age. I think she's 5 or 6 years older than me. that she was allowed to go to school. All my other aunts never went to school. After Gaddafi took over, his first order, I think, was that old people, young, whatever, whoever is illiterate is obliged to go to school. And for the old people, he made a special effort in every city, in every population where there was, they would bring teachers, the special teachers, to teach them at least how to read and write and to sign their name.
Yeah.
Imagine my grandmother didn't know how to write, and she learned by Gaddafi.
So Gaddafi, obviously, he takes, it's, I think it's the Green Revolution, was that what it was called?
Yes, it's Green Revolution, the Jamahiriya. It's right of the people or something.
Yeah, he takes his doctrine, he gets raises Libya up to very high levels of standards to where he's going to be rewarded, or awarded, I should say, by the United Nations for his efforts about a month before the attack on Libya. And
that is exactly.
Yeah, so we've got a guy that did a wonderful job during his life for his people. How, what is it, because obviously there was dissent, I mean, it wouldn't have been so bad to where it would have been overthrown, but how does dissent get into a country like Libya that, it, like you said, all these people come to Jordan were anti-Gaddafi. How does it happen when you have a leader that's done so much for their people? What type of soft power was being used to dissuade or to persuade Libyans that Gaddafi was such a bad guy? Or what really happened in the power structure there?
Okay. We were under an embargo for over 13 years. In these 13 years, we lost a lot. And I mean, we lost a lot. We had no ability of building new buildings. We had roads and what have you. In these 13 years, we could have been the second Dubai or the first, depending how you see it. And we couldn't do that. So we still had in 2008, 2009, some roads that they were only from sand and not asphalt on the road. So that is one point. A lot of rather the ones from Benghazi, they were thinking that they were left out, that he didn't assist them very much, and a lot of things. Let me put it the other way around, though. It was not so much that inside Libya they were against him. From Benghazi, a lot of agents, counting also Qatar, also
Qatar, Jordan. Yes,
Jordan was also involved. Turkey was involved. Of course, always under the blessing of America. And they sort of tried to manipulate the whole thing. In 17th of February of 2011, and prior 2 days to that, the protests were made for the prisoners of Abu Salim in Tripoli. There has never been a confirmation of these 1,200 prisoners that they were killed by the soldiers inside, but
Knowing the tribal nature of your country, Jordan, Saudi, it never happened. You just can't go kill 1,200 people because the repercussions would be terrible.
Well, Gaddafi never gave the order. That is one thing that I do know. But it's like, let me put it this way. It's like you have a company. You're the CEO and you have the people underneath you. You don't get all the information. You get only the most important information. The rest, it's done down by the little guys. Now, the little guys, if he hates my guts, he will do everything to get rid of me. So I cannot put all the blame on one leader who his subordinates underneath him do something else which is not under his control. That is one thing. Not that I refuse that these 1,200 people were killed. I don't know if they were killed. I haven't seen them. So I have no, I cannot criticize or give my opinion to it. I only get this information through what I read in and when I was living there. In Benghazi, Benghazi was always, since 1969, Benghazi was the last state that accepted Gaddafi after, I think, 2 or 3 years. I mean, he was in power in 1969. I think around 72 or 73, they accepted Gaddafi. So there was a little bit of a conflict, but not to the position or to the point of bringing down the government.
Now, did you guys within? Because I understand first, did you spend some time with Libyan intelligence, either formally or informally?
Informally, in 2011, actually, I gave my, I offered myself to them at that time. I told them I know what I can do. I offer this. I have the 5 languages in my back, and I can assist. And they needed all the assistance they could get.
Sure. Do they call it Mukhabarat there also?
Yes.
So you offered to the Mukhabara. So at what point do you think that the leadership in Libya started to feel a little concerned? Because we were looking at it here. I saw Tunisia fall. I saw Egypt fall. I said they're setting this up because now they can control both borders and flood the place with arms. This place is set up.
That was the setup. That was a setup. And the late Ambassador Stevens had assisted very much in Benghazi. Also, a lot of MI6, the French agencies also. Plus, in Benghazi, they had hired the French agency, also private contractors. Now, the so-called massacre... that they say that it happened. Jalil, the one who was NTC so-called minister or prime minister, admitted in 2014 that they were agents dressed like Libyans. There was no Libyan. No one was killed. On the contrary, they killed a lot of soldiers of ours. Sorry. That is when it happened. They only found out in 2014, the truth came out. One person, rather one newspaper made a hell of a job was Al Jazeera. It was stationed in Benghazi. I know 3 reporters that I had a big fight with them. Word-wise, phone-wise, Twitter-wise, and Facebook-wise. One was apprehended, but let go after a few days, I think, because they were lying through their teeth. They were saying this and this is happening in Tripoli, and I'm telling them, actually, they were saying near the Green Square. I live near the Green Square, so I said, okay, how can you say that this is happening when I am there exactly on the spot and I don't see any of your reporters?
You know, this brings up an issue because I spend a lot of time in Saudi Arabia also, and they have real problems with Al Jazeera. As you know, the Saudi government is really upset about the way Al Jazeera goes about its reporting, if you want to call it that. And really involving itself in issues to just stir up emotions and involve itself really in the politics of foreign countries. Well, what you're saying is pretty much supporting what Saudi Arabia is saying right now.
Don't get me started about Saudi Arabia, please. I mean, Saudi Arabia is the worst of the worst. I mean, okay. Saudi Arabia taught Qatar what to do. Saudi Arabia is one of the biggest.
When did they teach them? Because they had like no relations from 2002 to 2010.
That is what you say. They were always on relationship together. They always spoke with each other. What's his name? The prince of Qatar, the fat one, not his son, the Al-Thani, the first one, always spoke with Faisal. And that I know as a fact. The so-called barking.
Okay, so let's take it back, though. They're saying, though, right now that they are targeting Qatar, Al Jazeera for these issues. So they are correct, though, are they not?
They are correct, but they are a few years late. Al Arabiya was doing the same about Libya. Al Jazeera.
I agree they're late, and I know or I suspect that's because there are sea changes in the geopolitics underneath, subsurface.
Not only that. Gaddafi knew too much. Gaddafi was a very intelligent person. I maybe not like him. I maybe and please don't mistake when I say I don't like him. I'm a person who hates authority. Whether I am in Europe or in Libya or in Jordan or wherever, authority for me is something that I despise.
So you could hang out with us on the beach in Long. you'll be fine. You'll be welcome on the beach with us in Huntington Beach, California.
Okay. So you understand what I mean by authority. So Gaddafi for me, when I was young, from the age of 10 till 25, this military stuff and the authoritarian style wasn't exactly in my likings. But if I put it differently, and when I was discussing with one of the people who worked in the government, and he said, okay, you don't like authority, fine, I can accept that. Let me put it differently for you. You say you want to live in a country where there is freedom of speech, where is this, where is that, whatever. What do you think Europe has? I said, well, Europe is free. I mean, you can choose. You can say whatever you want. And he tells me, okay, let me remind you, when you went to north of Europe with your Libyan passport, how free did you feel? I said, actually, I was not allowed to go to certain places when they stamped my passport. Okay. And when you sued them because they did not allow you to stay in the country to finish your studies, what happened then? I said, I won the court. They allowed me to finish my studies, but then I was a person non grata for that country. With a Libyan passport, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So where is that freedom?
Yes, exactly. Freedom's relative.
Exactly. Freedom and democracy is just a word.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the difference between democracy and the military style, let's say, in Libya, is this. Gaddafi would say till 1980, I think 84, 84, 89, when he stopped governing and then the government took over. He would say, this is what I'm going to do. Didn't ask our opinion. In a democratic country, they ask us. They will say, let's take England, for example, about Scotland becoming an independent country. Do you remember how much they pushed the Scots through advertising not to vote against the split? Now, that's not democracy. So what they did, the democracy is we say one thing, but we do what we want from the behind. While with the military, you already know. Take, for example, North Korea. North Korea, you're not allowed to speak about the government. You're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to do that. You know where you stand with them. Now, if you want to be a partisan, you can do it. You will find a way. In the democracy, you cannot become a partisan because nothing will wake you up. They will come these advertisements, these spots that they will tell you, you know, we want the best thing for you. So we give our freedom up. Since 9/11, check how many freedoms they have taken away from each person in the whole of Europe and in the United States. You have cameras everywhere. You have listening device everywhere. You have even Google listening into you and taping you, whatever you say, whether you're talking about sex or whether you're talking about politics or whether you're talking with your friend about God knows what. Mm. And when they need it, they will use it against you. So where's the democracy? Yeah,
unfortunately, you're right about that. You know, it's just they fish and they fish and they fish and they throw out their big net. And when they need something, they'll just pull it out of the net and say, see,
exactly.
We got.
So what they do, the countries of Europe and the United States, they play false flags, continuous false flags. The unfortunate thing is, and this is what I wanted to write to my on my blog tonight, was, okay, we know that the agencies, all agencies all over the world, they play games. They play mind games. They use the people. They manipulate. You know that. Why do you fall continuously on the same trap? That I cannot understand. America had already had an Iraqi war and saw the results of it. And they go to war in Libya, whatever for, because they were going to lose the petrodollar and get the gold dinar. It's about high time. The dollar, it's just a paper. It's not backed with gold. It's not backed with silver. It's not backed even with copper.
It's backed with a U.S. military and thermonuclear weapons. That's what it's
exactly.
Backed.
Okay. Yeah. So that is the reason why they had to get rid. And of course, don't forget that Gaddafi pulled a big stunt towards the Americans and the English. Gaddafi was brought by the CIA in 1969. He was installed by the United States. What they didn't expect, they made the same mistake as they did with Castro. They didn't expect that it would happen with Gaddafi for whatever reason, I don't know. And in 1970 or 71, Gaddafi kicked out both bases, the English base in Tobruk and the American base in Tripoli in Willis. Kicked them out completely. Bear in mind, though, that the American government at that time warned Gaddafi that if he persisted that to kick out Willis base, the whole of Tripoli underneath is with mines. The Willis base had mined the whole of the underneath of the underneath the ground of Libya, of Tripoli. And he said, go ahead, do that. Let's see what the result comes out. And that is how the United States moved to Italy.
Hmm.
So that is something the Americans never liked. And that is, after 1971, the demonization of Gaddafi started. He's financing IRA, he's financing terrorists, he's giving guns here, he's doing that there, and the poor guy
was just sitting in Tripoli, just minding his own business. Everybody hang tight, it is Miriam Alpha, media, right up. All right, everybody, welcome back. It's the Fetch, rolling through 3 hours of intelligent media for the politically aware. Our guest is a native Libyan, I guess we can say. Her name is Miriam Al-Fatah. Her website is Libya Against Superpower Media. And you definitely want to go check that out. It looks like she was recently on Deanna Spingola's show Is that true? Did you go on Deanna Spingola?
Yes, I did.
And how was the show? I'm trying to find.
Very good. Very good. I don't know how it turned out, but I was very excited and very satisfied.
Well, that's good. You've been making the rounds. You've been all over the alternative media as of late, from what I hear.
Yes, and that I have to thank Michael Goodrich. We talked after Nick Sparrow's interview, and with Michael, we started discussing me writing a book, which I still haven't finished the draft, which I have to send him. But he offered to introduce me to all of you and to get the word out about Libya and what's going on.
And yeah, let's kind of like fast forward everything and what is going on. Obviously, you're familiar with Libya. How many governments do you have there now? I think there's two, correct?
No, three.
There is three. Okay. Can you give us a breakdown of the three governments and what they kind of stand for and where they're located?
All right. The House of Representatives is the one internationally recognized. It was elected in 2014.
It's in Tobruk.
Yes, that is in Tobruk. They had to leave because they were being blackmailed by the militias or shot, or they had the gun onto their brains if they didn't agree to do what the militias wanted. So they decided to move the government to Tobruk.
Okay.
In 2014, July, Misrata, the most hated tribe, which is a mix of Turks, Jews, mind you, not the Palestinian Jews or the Libyan Jews, but Jews that I don't know from where they came from.
Hmm.
This is the mix of Misrata people. Misrata, to remind your listeners, are the ones who massacred all the black population in Tawerga and displaced them. Around 3,000 families next door village from Misrata. So these militias from Misrata and the Misrata tribe decided that it would take over captive the capital of Libya. Although they had come to an agreement with the other tribes in Tripoli, they did not hold the word, and they came in, they started shooting, and they burned the international airport down. My family escaped from this Holocaust on a military ship. Libya for Tripoli for 2014 till today, they are living very difficult as to impossible to live in. We have become Tripoli has become so occupied by two governments. One is the Muslim Brotherhood government, the GNC, and the UN-backed government with Siraj, who is installed by the UN, who has not been accepted, although they try to push and pull and do whatever to have him accepted, but he's not been accepted by no one. Although
Siraj is with the Government of National Accord, correct?
Of the United Nations. No, it's not of the National Accord. It's of the United Nations. It's a UN-backed government. The National Accord is the one of the GNC, which is a Muslim Brotherhood, which no one wants.
So the Europeans, when they mapped this out, they put Prime Minister al-Siraj as head of the Government of the National Accord. This is from the EU.
Yes.
So that's...
That is true, and they're collecting money out of it.
Okay.
EU And the United States, they don't do anything unless they are going to collect something out of it.
Well, you know, business.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's a dirty business, but business.
I know. And the thing is that nobody wants to wake up. They're still sleeping. And that is what gets me really off my rockers. And and usually when I travel to Tripoli, I am so angry that I can barely speak out of anger.
Now, I know that some officials from Haftar's government, the government in,
in Tobruk.
In Tobruk, I was in the middle of Saudi Arabia 2 years ago, and they basically paid to get me out to come fly and meet with them for some issues also because of my relations here. That was rather interesting. They have, I know, represented here, I think in Dubai, UAE. But these guys are... How is Haftar? Isn't he part of a pretty big military organization?
He is the long hand of the United States. He's an CIA asset.
Mm-hmm.
He is not accepted by the people. But we... how can I put it now? We put him in front because he's the less dangerous than the other two that they are in Tripoli. And we can control most of the time Haftar's movements. Haftar, as a whole, although America is trying to install him as president in Libya, they even sent him, how do you call these people, that the image maker, to dress like Gaddafi, to speak like Gaddafi, to walk like Gaddafi. And wherever Gaddafi has been and however he traveled, they have used the same thing for Haftar, so that
You're talking like they're almost creating a Hollywood caricature to try to mold people into believing it's back to the old days.
Exactly.
Interesting.
You only have to watch. How can I say it? If I send you by email some of the pictures of Gaddafi's visits, and the same pictures of Haftar to the same places where he visited, where Gaddafi had visited, you'll see the resemblance. You understand what I mean?
I do, actually, yeah. There's other players there, of course. You know, obviously Libya has a very large reserve of very beautiful oil, if I'm going to use a Trump phrase there. Who controls the petroleum facilities? Is that Ibrahim Jadran?
House of Representatives.
The House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Most of it's under their control. And very few, I think, I may be mistaken, but very few oil fields are under the control of Tripoli. I don't know who the... main players on the oil that they are playing, but I know that most of the oil is under the control of the House of Representatives.
And that would be the Tobruk government?
Yes. Okay. You see, all the Libyans have accepted the House of Representatives, and they have not accepted the other two governments. Now, in Tripoli, it is like saying that Amman, which is the capital of Jordan, is held captive by two other militias.
Yeah, like if we had some tribe in Erbid and some tribe down south in Karak controlling the two. Something like that.
So you can understand. Imagine now that in Tripoli, a lot of people, I mean, everybody's working normally, 9-to-5 jobs, and they can't get paid. There is no money. The banks will not give money out. Now, either you have to go with a check or with a credit card, but money isn't flowing. And Tripoli is starving to death. We are talking about Tripoli of 2017. Imagine that till 2011, before the bombing started, we didn't have one homeless person.
Mm.
We didn't have one who was starving. We had a lot of refugees that we gave them jobs, and they didn't travel to Europe. We dissolved the refugees, and when I mean dissolved, we didn't kill them. We had them, we put them into work and everything.
Yeah, you absorbed them.
We absorbed them completely. And let me put it this way, the other way around. Gaddafi was a man who had balls. I'm sorry for the expression. He stood up, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Iran, America, Europe, and NATO for 8 months. 8 solid months. This man stood up. And we didn't have any new ammunition, no new airplanes, no nothing. We hadn't changed them since 2008. So what we were fighting, NATO and all these military people that they were coming in, we were fighting them with old guns, not with new ones.
Mm-hmm.
And if NATO hadn't bombed us 24/7 for 8 months, this would have never happened. The rebels, the so-called good rebels for the Americans, I can't remember the name how they used to call them. They couldn't get an inch if it wasn't for NATO. NATO, Red Cross, Doctors Without Borders. All these betrayed the Libyan people. And I'm talking about the people. I'm not talking about the military. What the military does with others who have the guns together, that's their problem. They get killed. It's something that you understand. But innocent civilians, that I cannot forgive, the Red Cross and the Doctors of Free Border and yeah. NATO altogether.
Medicine Sans Frontières is making a mess, too. They're running NGO ships now. They're basically flooding Europe and Italy with all kinds of, this is an issue now that the Europeans...
Well, you know, paying.
Yeah, who is?
Soros.
Soros is paying this, yes. Okay, good. So it looks, because a lot of us believe that part of the reason they took down Libya was because they wanted, meaning Soros wants to take down Europe. And the only way to get to take down Europe was to take down Libya and take away the central power and control so that then all these migrants could come through and they could just ferry them over to Europe as if nothing happened.
I don't know. That is one scenario. And there is another scenario that Merkel had made a contract with Qatar to destroy Libya. I mean, you can hear a lot of scenarios playing around. I mean, each one has his own interests. You hear Hillary Clinton, she had her interest. There is also another scenario, was the one that because Gaddafi had financed Obama's election, and when I mean financed, he sponsored, I don't know what he did exactly, but didn't give any money to Hillary Clinton's group, and she held that against him. There are a lot of things, but one main thing was that Sarkozy was afraid that Gaddafi would spill the beans about his election and how he was elected. Another scenario that was playing in 2011 was that Qatar and France, they wanted the biggest chunk of oil, so they invented this war. But if we go back to history, or rather the one that it is already written by the winners, the bombing started only when all oil contracts were null and void. Had the contracts been, let's say, in April, NATO wouldn't have bombed. They would have waited. And the war wasn't only for oil. There were many, many factors. Oil was one. The gold-backed dinar was second. the water that we could feed, we could supply water for Africa and Europe for another 50 to 100 years. Planting also the Sahara, making it like Palestine or like the Israelis did in Palestine, make it green from desert, that would mean for a lot of NGOs and people who were exporting to Libya, they would decline, their businesses would close. So there were many factors why Libya should be destroyed. It's not only for the refugees to come over. And mind you, these refugees are only Africans. There are no Syrians coming.
Yeah, they're not Syrian. We know that. Yeah, we know that. This is all. It's not even Libyans. It's sub-Saharan. Like we heard the other day, Haftar is shooting at NGOs now, warning shots, saying, get the hell away from us. We're tired of this mess as much as some of the Europeans are. We're tired of this mess equally.
You know, actually, the one who isn't tired is Italy, because Italy now, with the blessings of Siraj, is going to colonize Tripoli again. And really? Although they are against, yes, it's they have already, their ships have, they are in the Bay of Tripoli. And it is something that all Libya is against the Italians. We don't want the Italians back.
For reasons we can understand, knowing history.
Not only that, do you know, and I have not seen it in any tabloid or newspaper, that Gaddafi had succeeded to get the first installment from Berlusconi for damages that the Italian colonizers did in Libya.
Well, that's news too. I didn't hear that one. See,
yes,
you're bringing news today. That's good.
He was the first man, president, whatever you want to call him, that he succeeded in making a country like Italy telling them you have to pay damages to Libya because you stayed from 1911 till 1945. The amount, I don't know how much it was, the amount, but I know that they collected the first installment just before the war. Now, imagine if the rest of the countries like Africa, Nigeria, Algiers, and all these other countries that they were colonized by the French, by the Dutch, by the English, would turn around and start asking compensation from England, from France, from Netherlands, and you name it. Mm. That would destroy Europe. Europe and America is on the brinks of collapse financially, economically. People do not want to understand that whatever taxes they are paying just to hold the banks up. If people would wake up and take their money out of the banks will disappear. Rothschild will unfortunately have to feed the banks and start giving back, because he's the one who's getting 99% out of all this money out.
Mm-hmm.
So Gaddafi, to me, whether I liked him as a person or not, that's beside the point. The guy, he took a poor country, made it to one of the richest countries, educated his people. We maybe didn't like some things, but find me a human being that will be satisfied with whatever it's been given. I mean, you go to a reception, a wedding reception, and you will hear the gossip saying, oh, the meat is too cold. Oh, what did she do that? Why did you put that there? I mean, I could do it better. Nobody's satisfied. And from 2008, Gaddafi had already started building, bringing God knows how many, 24/7 it was, Libya was under construction to become one of the second tourist attraction of Africa. In 2012, they were going to give us, they would give the new international airport, which would have been by United Nations and by European standards, one of the biggest airports in the world. Even big, Sorry.
It's okay.
We're listening.
So this is why the reasons that Gaddafi had to go.
So where forward now? We got about a minute and a half left. Where forward for Libya today?
Well, unless the Libyans wake up and join all the tribes, I don't see light.
Coming on, we'll try to bring you back. That was a fascinating hour, everybody. It's the Fetch Inside the Eye Live. See you all next week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.